Life's Everyday Mysteries Solved. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
Well, welcome back. I say back because it seems like it was yesterday that we spoke, and that was last Sunday. But another Sunday has rolled around, and time to launch things with a couple of questions. If you look at a freshly opened container of yogurt, you may well note some cinnaresis occurring. What is this cinnaresis? If you know the answer to that, 514-790-0800. Or text to 514-800. Those are also the contacts if any question arises about anything that I may be able to answer in the world of science. But as you know, I always ask two questions, so here's the second one. Glucomannan can be found in some dietary supplements that claim this extract from the root of a plant can help with weight loss. What plant is glucomannan extracted from? Once more, 514-790-0800 or text to 514-800. Okay, so there's the two questions. We're looking to find out what cinnaresis is and where you get glucomannan. A bit later in the show, I will have a special guest, a student, Sophie Eni, who is the winner of the Brain Bee competition that was held here in Montreal, actually at the Glenn Hospital. And it is certainly going to be a pleasure to speak to this bright student coming up after the traffic check at 3:15. Last week, I think I told you about the environmental working group's Dirty Dozen fruits and vegetables, where they try to scare us about the pesticide residues on fruits and vegetables. But now there's something else that this environmental working group, a nonprofit organization, that states its goal as providing of easy access to information you need to make smart, healthy choices. Well, they've come up with something else. And this time it's a concern about chloramphenicol. Okay, well, what was this all about? Anyway, the Environment Working Group often pushes organic products, which is not surprising since they do receive some funding from the organic industry. And EWG is generally critical of pesticides used in conventional agriculture and of many of the additives used by the food industry. And this often drifts from informing into alarming consumers. Well, now the Environmental Working Group has set its sights on chloramphenicol, a plant growth regulator that is sometimes used on oats, barley, and wheat to strengthen the stalk, and that is to keep the stalk from bending over. And that reduces crop loss when it comes to harvesting, which, of course, is profitable for the farmer. And hopefully that also reduces the price in the long run for the consumer. If the farmer benefits, the consumer should benefit. Canada, the UK, and the European Union allow the use of chloramphenicol, but the US does not. Although it allows the import of crops that have been treated with the chemical, as long as residues are less than 40 parts per million. Well, how do they come up with a number like that? It's based on what we call the No Observed Adverse Event Level, or NOAEL, which is the maximum dose that can be fed to animals without causing any effect. And then the NOAEL is divided by a factor of 100 to provide an extra margin of safety when it comes to determining the amount that can be safely consumed by humans in a day, and we can calculate that to be about 1 milligram. So what did the Environmental Working Group do? They purchased 96 urine samples. No, you don't find these in your pharmacy, but there are companies that provide such items. And EWG scientists also tested samples of oat cereals for the presence of the chemical. The results they found generated headlines that screamed about 80% of consumers having a chemical in their urine that causes fertility problems, and that this same chemical is found in oat cereals. Well, this needs a bit of commentary here. First, based on only 96 urine samples from unidentified donors, it is not valid to conclude that 80% of consumers in general have chloramphenicol in their urine. The samples were collected in three distinct locations in Florida, South Carolina, and Missouri, and we have no idea if the samples came from urban or agricultural communities. Also, finding chloramphenicol in the urine means that it passes out of the body, which it is known to do quickly, having a half-life of a few hours. Second, the amount detected in the urine was of the order of 15 nanograms, which is way below the acceptable daily intake. A study in Sweden that collected urine from 100 random individuals in the general population found similar results. The amounts detected were way below the acceptable daily intake. Now, as far as the oats go, the highest amount detected was 0.3 parts per million, which is way below 40 parts per million, the amount of residue allowed. An individual would have to eat, about 3 kilograms of oat cereal a day to reach a level where there may be some risk were that amount eaten every day. Third, the fertility problems were seen in animals fed higher doses than what humans could possibly consume, and were seen in some studies, but not others. You know, it is easy to scare people about chemicals if proper context is not provided. Remember that we're exposed to thousands and thousands of chemicals every day, the vast majority from natural sources. There are potential stories behind each one, and with cherry-picked and out-of-context data, it is possible to label just about any of these as a devil or angel. Strychnine can be made to sound angelic by focusing on its energy-boosting effect, with reference to Thomas Hicks, who won the 1904 Olympic marathon with the help of strychnine. You just don't mention that a slight overdose will rob you of energy permanently. Conversely, vitamin B12 can be portrayed as a devil by claiming correctly that it contains cyanide. Just keep quiet about the fact that it contains less than the amount found in the seeds of an apple. Similarly, apple juice can be linked to Satan by pointing out that it contains paculin, a genotoxic, potentially carcinogenic compound. Just conveniently ignore the fact that several gallons would have to be consumed to raise any specter of harm. Actually, somewhat less if the juice is organic, because paculin is produced by a mold, and that's more likely to infect organic produce that is not protected by, quote, chemicals. Numbers matter in science, and I keep emphasizing that. Numbers are the currency of science. And when you crunch the numbers about chloramphenicol, taking into account the amount of the residues found in food, the frequency with which those foods are consumed, and you consider the acceptable daily intake and the nebulous studies of the chemical's toxicity, I think its potential effect on health is pretty much a non-issue, unless you want to make it one by presenting data out of context. So the reason that I tell you this story is to show how important context is. And just saying that something contains a toxic substance doesn't tell you anything unless you know how much of this is found in the food, how that toxicity compares to what is really known to be dangerous. And then you can make some kind of an educated guess on whether or not you should be choosing that particular food. But numbers matter, and any data that is presented without numbers doesn't have much meaning.
Life's everyday mysteries solved. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
She blinded me with science. She blinded me.
couple of weeks ago, I had the chance to speak to a group of very smart students who had been selected by their high schools and SAGEPs to take part in a contest called the Brain Bee. This was organized at the Glenn Hospital, and it was to introduce students to the science of neuroscience. And the winner of that Brain Bee was Sophie Ine, who joins us on the line here. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, how are you?
Well, congratulations for winning this Brain Bee. And let me pick your brain a little bit for what this was all about. So tell us a little bit about the contest. What sort of questions, how did the Brain Bee work?
I mean, it was an hour long about online questions. And they came from two textbooks that we had to study. And it was, there were questions that involved clinical stuff, questions that involved neuroanatomy, theory, pretty much covering a lot of bases, a lot of questions that involved more critical thinking, but some were just brute memorization.
Now, I understand you go to school at Royal West, right?
Yeah.
And what grade are you in?
I'm in grade 10.
How did you get interested in neuroscience?
So this is actually a little bit of a story. I took part in my school's science fair last year where I did a project about sleep. And a neurologist actually noticed my project and ended up talking to me about this competition. And so this year, I started looking into that competition, and I figured, oh, well, this might be fun to participate in. And, well, here we are.
Well, so tell me, what was your science project about sleep all about?
So I did a study on how sleep affects cognitive function and logical reasoning. And so I gave people from my school an adapted version of the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. And I asked them how much sleep they got the night prior and how much sleep they get on average.
What was the average number of hours for the students at your age that they admitted?
I'm honestly not entirely sure. I think it was somewhere around seven and a half hours.
That's pretty good. And do you sleep more or less than that?
I need my 8 hours a night.
So your cognition must be very good, right? So did you find a relationship between the number of hours that they slept and their cognitive potential?
Yeah, for sure. In both the logic section and the cognitive function section, there was a correlation. I think the correlation coefficient was definitely a moderate correlation. I can't remember exactly what the numbers were, but it was for sure there.
Very good. I'm happy to hear that someone in grade 10 be able to talk about correlation coefficients. I can tell you that that's not a common thing among students in grade 10. What are your plans for the future?
I'm hoping to study medicine. I'm not sure exactly what or if I'd want to do like medicine and research together, but maybe something involving neurology, maybe something involving pediatrics, but we'll see.
What is the next step with the Brain Bee competition?
So I'm participating in the national round, the first part of the national round, April 20th, which takes place online. And if I do well in that, then I'll advance to the second part of the national round, which takes place in Vancouver.
Wow. So how does this work? You go online and you open some website, I assume, and you see the questions.
I'm guessing that it's actually a Zoom. It's a full day conference. So arranged with, I think, keynote speakers. And there are four different test sections. So neuroanatomy, clinical, and the regular neurology, neuroscience.
These are multiple choice questions?
I'm honestly not sure. At the local round, they were multiple choice. I think probably some of them will be and some of them won't be.
Did you actually get back the results of the competition that you did here?
Yeah, we did.
So how many questions were there?
There were 60 questions, one of which got removed because it was they decided that it was an unfair question. So overall, 59 questions.
And how did you do?
I got 43 right.
Well, that's pretty good. I mean, because these, I assume, were not straightforward questions, that you had to think about them, right? You had to apply critical thinking.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's really a pleasure for me to speak to someone your age who is so interested in science and who obviously is very competent in it as well. I assume your grades in high school are very good.
Yeah, they're pretty decent. Thank you.
Can we look forward to having you at McGill?
Yeah. I look forward to maybe being there.
Well, that would be great. That would be great. What science courses are you taking this year?
Well, this year I'm taking just the regular school science courses, so the science and technology and environmental science and technology. But I'd also taught myself the AP chemistry and biology courses.
What do you mean taught yourself, just from books?
So I did an online course, and yeah, there were books.
Oh, very good. And what was your motivation for doing that?
Well, I got pretty interested in chemistry, and I figured, you know, why not, just to learn.
Great. And that's the spirit.
Then for biology, my school actually offered a biology course, but it wasn't. I felt like our school's biology would be more like animal biology, and I was more interested in the human biology. So I thought, well, AP biology would be more up my alleyway. But I didn't quite realize, I don't think, what I was signing up for, because it still was a lot of, you know, plant and animal biology, but I still ended up really, I still found the content pretty interesting. So,
great. What hobbies do you have aside from studying?
I love to bake. I do a lot of baking. I play the violin. I like to read and crochet. I also like to climb from time to time, so to go bouldering.
Well, very good. And I'm sure that you'll be good at everything that you try. And I want to wish you the best of luck on the next phase of the competition, and then the one after that. And then if you win the Canadian one, then you're into the international, right?
Yep.
Well, that would be great. So keep me informed about what happens with your the next effort at the contest. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. So I wish you the best of luck. And it is, you know, so pleasing to see that we have students like you who are interested, who are interesting, and who understand about critical thinking, because that is what we really need. And I can tell you that I really appreciate that, because I speak to an awful lot of people who have no idea what critical thinking is all about. So all the best to you, and it's really a pleasure chatting with you.
Okay? Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
That was Sophie Ine, who's a student here in Montreal at Royal West High School. Obviously, very, very competent student. And indeed, many of the students that I met when I had the privilege of giving a talk to that group, all very, very impressive. So, you know, the future of science is in good hands, because we have a lot of such very good people out there.
Your source when you need answers. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
Won't you show me everything you've learned?
Okay, I got an interesting question here via text. And it's about removing sulfites from wine. You know that sulfites are sometimes added mostly to white wine to keep it from discoloring. Sulfites act as a preservative. But some people have a reaction to the sulfites. It's not exactly an allergic reaction. It's more of an intolerance. But it's annoying. So the question comes up of how you can remove sulfites from wine. And someone wants to know if stirring with a stainless spoon can help remove sulfites. No, I can't conceive that that can be of any help. On the other hand, hydrogen peroxide can do that job. Hydrogen peroxide can actually oxidize the sulfites to sulfates, which are innocuous. The question is how much hydrogen peroxide. I think the usual advice is to put about a milliliter of 3% hydrogen peroxide into a bottle of wine, and that should take care of the sulfites. Well, this question about wine triggered another idea for me, and that was the question of cork sniffing, which I've never really been into. I always thought it was kind of a snobby thing to do. But I never really looked into the practice because, you know, I don't drink all that much wine. But then one day I got into it a little bit when I was out with eating with a friend, and he ordered wine, sniffed the cork, and promptly declared the bottle to be unacceptable and sent it back. He said it was mushroomy. Well, I thought, you know, maybe this is more snobbery. After sniffing, he disdainfully tossed the cork on the table. Anyway, I picked it up, ready to give it a whiff, ready to declare that I smelled nothing. But you know what? That was not to be, because I did smell something. It was octane-3-ol, and I knew this smell. I had often used a vial of it in my organic chemistry class a long time ago to teach students about smells. Mushroom alcohol, we call it. It's a metabolite of fungi and has decided mushroom-like smell. And the cork just reeked of it. Well, that little adventure sent me scurrying to look into the chemistry of corks. It seems that mushroom alcohol is the least of cork makers' problems. Trichloroanisole, much bigger headache. We're talking major problems here for a huge industry. Believe it or not, some 10 to 12 billion corks are sold every year around the world, generating over $1 billion in sales. Each cork costs only about 15 cents, but it has huge responsibility. That little piece of tree bark has to protect a bottle of wine, which may be worth anywhere from a few dollars to a few hundred dollars. If a cork develops an off aroma and transfers this to the wine, the result can be economic catastrophe. As it happens, about 3 to 8% of all corked wines develop what is known as cork taint. Many compounds can contribute to that problem. The octane-3-ol I mentioned forms when the small amounts of fat in the cork are broken down by microbes which have contaminated the cork. Cork comes from the bark of a tree, mostly grown in Portugal. But there's a lot of processing in between stripping the bark and corking a bottle. Lots of opportunity for microbial infection, in spite of efforts to stop it. Corks are bleached with hypochlorite, but still, there's a lot of storage and shipping involved, giving microbes the opportunity to take up residence in the cork. These microbes can produce not only the mushroom smell, but even worse, they can form trichloroanisole. Wood contains naturally occurring phenols, which during the chlorine bleach treatment are converted to chlorinated phenols, which in turn react with microbes to yield the smelly anisole. That's what we call cork taint. What's the answer? Manufacturers have played around with all kinds of alternative sterilization techniques to protect the cork. But there's a far simpler answer. What about eliminating the cork? Screw cap bottles solve the problem, but You know, no real wine lover wants to be caught unscrewing a cap. So give them a plastic cork. There's a cork made of polyethylene, and that was developed, and it does eliminate the cork taint problem. Looks like a real cork, pulls out like a real cork, but doesn't smell like a real cork. Seems to be a great invention. And many wineries are already using this so-called neocork. Of course, the real wine snobs won't hear of it. You know what I say to them when they start going on about how wine needs to be naturally corked to develop a proper bouquet? Go put a cork in it, polyethylene one. But then, of course, I can already hear your mental gears grinding out there. What about the fact that that polyethylene cork then is a plastic, and doesn't that then contribute to environmental pollution? Yes, unfortunately, that is true. That would be a real concern. Polyethylene does not readily break down in the environment. And the polyethylene corks that are discarded will stay in landfills or wherever they end up for a very, very long time, slowly degrading into the horrors of microscopic or maybe even nanoplastics. But it does seem to solve the cork taint problem. All right. I also have a question here about the glasses that are used for the eclipse. And someone wants to know if a few layers of black garbage bag can be used instead of glasses. I suppose so. Light does not go through a black garbage bag, so I don't know if you're going to see anything at all. But the best idea is to use kind of glass were, you know, made for this, because those will filter out about all of the light, but they will still allow you to see the eclipse. So I don't know about the black garbage bags, but I doubt that they would be useful. Okay, well, I'm still looking for the answer to my other question. And I wanted to know, what is the phenomenon when you open a freshly opened can of yogurt and you see some synaresis going on? And I want to know, you know, when you note this synaresis, what is it that you are noting? What is this all about? If you know that, you give us a call at 514-790-0800. You can also text your questions to 514-800. But of course, you can also call by the phone. Although, it's interesting that I have noticed that since we started this whole phenomenon of texting, not only do I see my students sitting, you know, outside my office on the same bench texting to each other instead of talking, but I know that you guys would much, much rather text in your questions than phone in. And I guess this is just, this is the way that the world is evolving. We are all becoming digitalized. And I guess, you know, there's certain benefits to that. I mean, I like text messaging. You know, you get, you contact someone absolutely immediately. It has a certain downsides, though, is, you know, when you text someone or you email someone and you don't get an answer right away, what on earth is going on, you know, because we expect everything to be so instant. Anyway, you know, the whole digital technology, I think the benefits outweigh the risks, but, you know, there are some concerns there.
Your source when you need answers. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
What is the shape of a molecule? The protein molecule in question. We need the shape of the molecule to understand how it works.
Okay, I'm still looking for the question to my the answer to my question about synuresis. I guess if I spell it, it will give it away because you'll immediately look it up. But I guess that's fair enough. It's synneresis. Synneresis. And so the question was, when you're opening a fresh container of yogurt, you may well note some synuresis occurring. What is synuresis? Okay, let's go to the lines. George, I think, has a question. George?
Yes, and I don't know if I might contribute to the to a response to your question, but on two occasions when I had purchased yogurt, which contained a one-to-one association of sugar to protein, like there was no higher sugar content than protein content, maybe 19 grams of sugar versus 18 grams of protein. And I put that yogurt in the freezer, froze it, and before then I checked the integrity of the seal to note that it was well sealed. When I brought it down to the fridge to defrost it, then opened the seal, I observed a spot of mold, and that occurred on two occasions.
Well, I mean, you know, cold temperature or freezing does not stop all microbial reaction. It just slows it down. So how long had you been storing it for?
I had probably stored it overnight. I'd forgotten it in the freezer overnight.
Overnight? The mold formed overnight in the freezer?
No, excuse me. The yogurt that I purchased,
yeah,
I checked the seal.
Yeah.
It wasn't broken. It was well sealed. I then put the product in the freezer to make it cold because that's how I enjoy it. And then, I forgot it. I left it overnight in an attempt to defrost it thereafter. Upon opening the yogurt, opening the seal, I observed a spot of mold.
And this was the next day?
The next day. And that happened on two occasions.
That mold had to be there in the first place. I mean,
now, there was no way that I could have checked for mold because then I'd have to break the seal
of
the yogurt. And on two occasions with, again, significant time in between those purchases, so maybe after a new...
Well, all I can tell you that it was not the freezing process that did that. So the mold had to have been there before.
And it wasn't because of a lower sugar content?
No.
Okay.
No. And it's not the freezing that did that. So other than that, I don't know. I mean, you know, I've bought yogurt before and noticed that when I opened it that it was mold. You know, happens.
What an interesting random occurrence then.
Yeah, it is.
Because again, it happened on two separate occasions, and I thought perhaps...
Yeah, was it the same brand of yogurt?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the thing to do then would be to contact the company because, you know, ask if they've had other complaints like that.
Indeed, that's a good idea.
It's overnight freezing will not bring on mold. Okay, anyway, interesting. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I do have an answer to the question that I asked about the root of the plant from which glucomannan is extracted, and that is the konjac plant, which in Asia, the roots of it are eaten like a vegetable. It's a tuber, like a potato. But anyway, you know, it's unbelievable what people will believe, especially when it comes to weight loss. No matter how many magic pills have come and gone, hope reigns eternal that the next one that comes around will deliver the miracle of melting the fat away without paying attention to calories. And here's now another one. It's marketed by a company called Healthy Products for Life. Again, it's said to be a breakthrough that shows staggering weight loss, and it stunned doctors. You know, as soon as I see that phrase, stunned doctors, which you see in many of these ads, I know that nonsense is coming up. A giant newspaper ad that I saw boasted that you can eat the foods you love and crave and actually watch your weight plummet. There's even a generic picture of an unnamed doctor, not exactly looking stunned, and a recommendation not to lose weight too quickly. Furthermore, we learned that the pill is not intended for people who only need to lose 5 to 10 pounds. Well, what a clever way to hype the supposed power of this dietary supplement. There's also repeated reference to scientific proof without offering any reference. But there's a clue in the ad about what the pill is all about, because they actually do name what they call the secret ingredient. So it isn't really so secret. And neither is it anything novel. It is konjac root. Numerous other weight loss pills have this ingredient, and there's nothing magical about it. The root of the konjac plant has a long history of use in Japan in formulation of low-calorie foods because it contains glucomannan, a form of soluble fiber that has an amazing ability to absorb water and swell into a gel. The result is that it fills the stomach, leading to decreased appetite. Being of a slippery nature, the gel transits through the intestine quite easily and can have a laxative effect, which may be welcome to people struggling with constipation. A full stomach, be it from drinking lots of water or consuming soluble fiber, does have an appetite suppressant effect. But does that necessarily lead to weight loss? A few limited studies suggest it does. In an 8-week double-blind study of 20 obese people, a 1-gram supplement of glucomannan taken 1 hour before each meal resulted in a 6-pound loss over 8 weeks. An added bonus was a drop in blood cholesterol level. In a large placebo-controlled study of 200 overweight and obese subjects, a mixture of psyllium seed husks, 3 grams, and glucomannan, 1 gram, given either twice or 3 times a day, resulted in a roughly 10-pound loss over 4 months. So while there is at least some evidence for weight loss over the short term, there are no long-term studies. And there is something else to consider. That's a warning by Health Canada that glucomannan in tablet, capsule, or powder form has a potential for harm if taken without at least 8 ounces of water or other fluid. Cases have been reported in which glucomannan has led to choking and or blockage of the throat, esophagus, or intestine as it swells with water. In the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration have also warned about a choking hazard in children when gelatinous candies made with konjac root became lodged in the throat. Federal Trade Commission has also gone after some companies marketing konjac products for making weight loss claims that went far beyond what was supported by any clinical evidence. Obesity Research Institute, the marketer of FiberThin, Xylotrim, Propolene, Lipozine, settled charges by the FTC that their misleading weight loss claims violated federal laws. They agreed to pay $1.5 million in consumers' redress. Basically, what we have with konjac root products is the common ploy by marketers of natural products, building a mountain of hope from a molehill of evidence. So I'm not going to tell you that consuming glucomannan is totally useless when it comes to weight loss, because thickening up the contents of the stomach does reduce appetite. And as I said, that there are some studies, small scale studies, that over the short term can lead to weight loss. But as we know, no matter what kind of diet or supplement you're looking at, the long-term results are not there. After about a year, it all equalizes. Diets have the same efficacy. Supplements have no efficacy. And that's where it stands. Luckily, though, there are some real medications like Ozempic that can work when they are properly used. Anyway, that's it for today. We are out of time, but we'll be back with you same time, same station next week. Until then, I'm Joe Schwartz, hoping all the chemistry in your life comes out just right.